side of Philadelphia took home the top prize at this year's Pillsbury Bake Off. She wowed the judges with her recipe for pumpkin ravioli with salted caramel whipped cream. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, we invited Christine to tell us how she came up with her prize-winning dessert, what it was like to compete in Orlando, Florida, and how she got interested in competitive cooking. Later, we'll talk about this and other cooking competitions with a culinary historian and a food writer who was a judge at this year's contest. We also want to hear from you if you've ever entered a food or cooking contest. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. But first, Christina Varelli, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, and congratulations.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm wondering how much your phone has been ringing off the hook in the last week.
I've been pretty busy.
So how many false starts? How did you come up with this? And I'll say it again, pumpkin ravioli with salted caramel whipped cream. How did you come up with this recipe?
You know, I guess it developed. I was thinking about some little donuts that they serve at Nectar Restaurant in Berwyn. They're like little warm donut balls, and they shake them in a little paper bag with sugar, and then they come out with three dipping sauces.
Yeah.
And I just love the idea of the warm pastry and the dipping sauce. And then there was also another recipe that inspired me. It was a crescent roll sopapilla, and it had cream cheese and butter and crescent roll and cinnamon, and I just kind of liked those flavors together, and I just thought about it for a while, and
voila,
ravioli, right? Came to me, and I went through a whole bunch of different versions. The first one actually was just plain cream cheese, and it developed into the pumpkin ravioli.
And would you say your family are your, the at least the initial judges for this particular recipe?
They are. They're my guinea pigs, I call them.
Lucky them. Were you nervous?
At the actual bake-off?
Yes.
I wasn't that nervous cooking. I told someone else that, you know, if you're a busy parent at home and you're used to cooking for a family and you're juggling, you know, soccer practice and piano lesson and, you know, somebody wants, you know, ketchup and somebody needs a drink and somebody needs help with multiplication and mom, can I Google this? It's just...
This is easy, right?
It seemed you had 4 hours and it was just... You know, there were press walking around, but I didn't feel that nervous during the actual cooking. I was nervous during the actual, you know, calling of the winner.
Sure, the actual decision about who won. Did they give you down there, and we're talking about, I guess, a ballroom in Orlando, Florida, did they give you a full kitchen to work with?
You can't even imagine. It's amazing. They have a giant, more like a convention hall. And GE actually makes ranges just for the bake-off. I think they've partnered up with Pillsbury for many, many years. And they make 102 brand-new ranges, 100 for the finalists and 2 for backup. So you have your own range, and then you have, I don't know, about a 30-inch wide countertop cabinet. And they just line these stations up in big, long lines, and it just fills the ballroom. Just imagine the electricity needed.
I can't imagine. Even the smells, and probably good smells, emanating as well. Did you have an assistant? Did you have runners? I mean, people who were there to help you?
They do have runners that can help just get your products from the refrigerators, which were on the edges of the convention hall. And nobody's really allowed to help you do anything, just to keep it all fair and square. And then there's also someone, when you're happy with your recipe and you want to take it to the judges, it's a really exciting moment. One of the runners walks in front of you and clears the way so you don't trip and drop your recipe, and everyone's clapping, and it's really a great moment.
Wow, and just how cutthroat is the competition at the Pillsbury Bake Off?
It's tough competition. I mean, they get tens of thousands of recipes, and, you know, just to make it as a finalist, you're a huge winner. Just to be a part of that historical competition, and they treat you so well, and we have wonderful dinners and luncheons and guest speakers, and you win a microwave and you win $125, and they fly you down and put you up at a beautiful hotel.
Well, and as the winner, you won $1 million.
Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
It just doesn't seem real yet. I don't know if it's ever going to seem real.
Have you thought about how you're going to spend that money? I know you have children, so maybe perhaps that's where the money will go.
I do have two little girls, and I'm just not going to do anything crazy. You know, I've got to put some away for college, and we have some, you know, projects around the house that are going to need attention that we haven't, you know, been able to attend to.
You said the nervous part, and this makes sense, is when the judges were judging the various desserts in your case.
Right.
Butterfly nervous? Nail-biting nervous?
I don't know. Nail-biting. You're in there with the other finalists, and there's, like, a great camaraderie between us. You would think it would be competitive, but it's really supportive, and we're all excited to be there, and we're, like, holding hands and, like, patting each other on the shoulder for everybody's category. And Martha said, right before she said the dessert winner, she said that she tried this recipe. And I know that she never stopped at my station at the bake-off, so I figured at that moment, you know, I was done for because I knew she hadn't tried it. But she told me later that she tried it back in the judge's room.
And we're talking about Martha Stewart here.
Right. It was the winner was announced live on the Martha Stewart show, and it was actually broadcast down at the same hotel where the event took place.
And are there pictures of you at that moment, the you know, either laughing, crying, screaming, yelling?
Yeah, there's lots of pictures of me bawling. My girls keep teasing me.
Oh, you were moved to tears.
I was. It was just so amazing.
Well, you know what? I do want to get a caller on, and we have Brett who's joining us, and he's actually joining us from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Brett. I know Brett.
Well, he knows you, Christina, and we do want to bring Brett in on the conversation, and he's on line one. Brett, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi, there.
Tina. I just wanted to say this could not have happened to a nicer person. I've had the pleasure of competing with Tina in a few competitions, most recently at the Pillsbury Bake Off contest this year, and I was so happy that she took home the top honor. She was just a pleasure to compete with, and is just a very talented, good friend, and just wanted to send my congratulations out.
Well, and that's really nice, Brett. You were one of the, five men finalists this year, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I was in the dessert category as well with orange cream macadamia torte, and I was lucky enough to win the Eagle Brand sweetened condensed milk signature award.
Wow.
So really excited about that. Got to bring home a little bit of cash along with the great time. But the best part of the contest is just interacting with the other finalists and getting to know home cooks from all over the country. And all it takes is just a really, really good idea, a little bit of inspiration, and anybody can do this. Those of us that compete are just home cooks. We just love to be creative in the kitchen, and you know, the award is $1 million, and it's incredible. And Tina, it's real.
It is. Go ahead, Christina.
I think I need to be pinched. It's still not real.
But you remember Brett from the competition?
I do. Brett and I met at our first bake-off. We were both lucky enough to be finalists at the 44th bake-off in 2010. And then we stayed in touch, and we were at a couple other events together. And it's just you can meet so many great friends doing these cooking competitions, and, you know, you just love to do the same things, and somebody understands what you're talking about, and it's just a wonderful group. And I'm so surprised that you're on, Brett. How exciting.
Well, I heard Marty mention the show, and I said, you know, I have got to call in and chat.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Congratulate you again now that it's settled down. So, and we have to do lunch soon, and you're buying.
Oh, I can't wait. I will buy, and congrats on your Eagle Brand Prize as well.
Brett, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Brett, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Christina, I just want to spend a couple more minutes with you before we have to say goodbye. So have you been a lifelong cook?
I have been a lifelong cook. I don't know the exact age that I started, but my mom says I was pretty young, and she thinks my first recipe were brownies.
Oh, can't go wrong with that.
No.
Are you a kind of a dessert person then? Is that your specialty?
You know what? I'm not really that huge of a dessert person, which is even more surprising. I like to do a lot of just, you know, homey dinners, you know, pot pies and soups and homemade pizza, you know, all the good comfort foods.
And do you come from a and you have two children. Are they also interested in cooking like you?
They do like cooking. They love when we make sugar cookies and they get to decorate them. They like to help roll meatballs, and they do like to get in there and help.
Do you have family recipes? Are there recipes that have been handed down in your family, or is it more DIY, do it yourself?
Well, for the contest, I try to come up with something original, but we definitely have family recipes that will be passed down through the family.
Will you be entering more contests?
I don't know. I've been so busy, and it's just been a whirlwind. I do love the contest. It's addicting once you start, so who knows?
Now, do you watch cooking shows and things like that on TV? Are you, a Food Network watcher?
I do. I do love the cooking shows, and I've been watching the cooking shows, back when it was on PBS. Some of the, Marianne Esposito and...
Julia Child?
Exactly. I just used to really enjoy, they were relaxing for me. And I think you probably absorb a lot of tips, from watching the shows.
And you're still thinking about what to do with that $1 million? Not to be totally crass here, but how do you get that money?
It's actually an annuity, and they spread it out over 20 years.
Well, that's probably even better. So you don't go bonkers, right?
It is. It's like a extra, like a bonus salary, which is wonderful.
I was also reading that you and your husband, now you live outside of Philadelphia, have bought a music venue?
Yes. We're partners with our good friends, the Varallos, and it's in Ardmore, Pennsylvania. It's kind of an iconic rock club.
Oh, wow.
My husband has been a part-time musician his whole life, and he always wanted to do a little bit something more with music. So we're giving this a shot, and it's been a lot of fun.
So the Varellis and the Varallos?
Isn't that confusing?
It is confusing. I looked up your recipe, and I thought with whipped cream, caramel... It's 380 calories, that's a significant number of calories, but frankly, I thought it was going to be a lot more than that.
Right. It's nice because it's not, everyone tells me it's not overly sweet and that, they're small, so you can eat one or you can eat two. It's not like you're committing to a big portion.
Well, on that note, Christina Varelli, thank you so much. Congratulations, and thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. She's the winner this year of the Pillsbury Bake Off. She won $1 million for her pumpkin ravioli dessert with salted caramel whipping cream. And we put that recipe on our Facebook page. We'll carry on our conversation after this very short break with two guests waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business proudly supports WHYY. The Rohrer College of Business is one of five business schools in the nation to hold the prestigious AACSB accreditation for business and ABET accreditation for its Management Information Systems program. Rohrer's next MBA information session will be held at 6 p.m. on April 10th in Cherry Hill. 856-256-4024 or rowan.edu/MBA. Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business. Experience personal learning. Experience your future.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Peter Beinart talks about his new book, The Crisis of Zionism. He supports Israel, but thinks the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are compromising Israel's commitment to democracy. He's proposed a boycott of goods made in those Jewish settlements. We'll get a response from Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of the Jewish Week of New York. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by the McCarter Theater Center in Princeton, presenting An Evening with Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series, on Friday, April 20th at 8 p.m. Presented in association with the Friends of the Princeton Public Library, An Evening with Alexander McCall Smith at McCarter Theater. Tickets and more information at 609-258-2787. or online at mccarter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We just said goodbye to Christina Varelli, this year's winner of the Pillsbury Bake Off, which took place in Orlando, Florida, just a week or so ago. And the Pillsbury Bake Off began actually in 1949, and it was originally called the Grand National Recipe and Baking Contest. Joining us now to talk more about the Pillsbury Bake Off and other food competitions is Laura Shapiro. She's a culinary historian, author of two books about women and cooking in America, one called Perfection Salad and the other called Something from the Oven. She was listening in. And Laura Shapiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me go back just to put Christina's win into some kind of context. Back to 1949, this was the original Pillsbury Bake Off. What was Pillsbury trying to promote at that time?
Well, when the Bake Off began, it was the idea of their advertising agency, which was the Leo Burnett Company, one of the very prominent advertising companies of that time, and it was their idea to promote flour, which was actually a very radical thought. The idea of putting a brand name on flour and people would go to the supermarket to pick out a specific kind of flour was something that just it just hadn't been thought of before. But Pillsbury and the other flour companies were experiencing a drop in flour sales after the war, in part because people did not do as much home baking, particularly bread, as they had done in the olden days, and also because people were eating less bread. Dieting had come in the 20s, and consumption of bread was down. So all these flour companies are working to increase sales of flour, mm-hmm. and Burnett had this idea of staging a huge cooking contest where the one thing you would need to enter a recipe would be half a cup of flour. So that was the idea. It was quite controversial at the time. After the war, they thought that baking was really over, home baking from scratch, and that everybody was just going to be using mixes and buying things from the bakery. Nobody would enter a contest like this. They were afraid of all the things that could go wrong. When Christina said that GE made 102 ranges with two for the backup, that was very interesting to me to hear, because one of the issues they dealt with in 1949 as they were thinking of this was, what if one of the stoves didn't work and the contestant then could sue Pillsbury? So
no,
they were
goodness.
Afraid of that. So clearly GE was on the case, and they had those extra ranges there. So it was a controversial idea. It succeeded beyond their wildest expectations. It was hugely popular. Mountains of publicity. You couldn't buy that publicity. And apparently, after that first bake-off, they had 700,000 new customers for Pillsbury flour.
So it worked.
It really worked, and it became an annual thing.
And what was interesting is it took place at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, quite a swanky hotel in New York. Eleanor Roosevelt gave out the winning, I guess, award, and the winner received $50,000, a lot of money in 1949. The recipe was No Need Water Rising Twists.
Yes, it was an old-fashioned recipe. In 1949, the recipes were pretty much all from scratch, and this one was an old technique that really people weren't doing anymore, where you made the dough and you wrapped it in a tea towel and submerged it in water, and it rose kind of underwater. And the judges loved that. They thought it was great, and apparently it was a simple, doable recipe. And as you can tell now, Martha Stewart is in charge of the great moment at the end. And back then it was Eleanor Roosevelt, and after Eleanor they had the Duchess of Windsor. So they've always to have these major people, whether or not they had anything to do with food. Martha at least has a food pedigree. Eleanor Roosevelt, and believe me, the Duchess of Windsor was not known for her Epicurean taste, but
not surprising there.
Right. But they always had a big publicity getting a figure to give out the prizes.
Well, I'm looking here at the eligible products. That's from this year's Pillsbury Bake Off. List A, you have to pick one from List A and one from List B. List A is all Pillsbury products, whether it's flaky layers of refrigerated biscuits or a crusty French loaf. List B includes Progresso broths, Muir Glen tomatoes, Jif peanut butter, Smucker's jams and jellies, preserves. This is really all about branding, is it not?
It really is. It wasn't in the beginning. In the beginning, it was about Pillsbury flour. And as I say, the requirement was you had to use at least half a cup of flour. You were not allowed to enter a recipe that used a cake mix, even though mixes were out and about and Pillsbury was making them. You were not allowed to do that. It was about celebrating home cooking from scratch. And for the first, 10 or 15 years, that's really what it was. And it was kind of amazing at a time when all the press and the food industry and everybody was busy trying to convince the world that American women hated to cook, wanted to get out of the kitchen, wanted only fast recipes and quick and easy products and so forth. Here was this company doing very, very well by putting a huge spotlight on women's home cooking at least its most kind of exciting and creative. Then about the mid-50s, Pillsbury expanded to allowing and then finally requiring mixes and other of their quick products. And then as the company acquired other companies or created relationships with other companies, they added more and more products that you either could use or had to use. By now, it really is it's a kind of a quest in putting together packaged foods. The whole thing is really very different. But in the beginning, it was a real celebration that flew in the face of what everyone was saying about American cooking.
And just more from that list, be Crisco cooking oil, Eagle brand sweetened condensed milk, Land O'Lakes eggs, Land O'Lakes stick butter. I mean, I think people get the sense of what we're talking about here in terms of products and branding. But the prize money is a lot of money. I mean, back in 1949, $50,000. Maybe that is like $1 million today. I don't know.
It is. That is really, I don't think this is crass to say it. That's really kind of the greatness of the Bake Off. They didn't just say, oh, you're wonderful, you're queen of the kitchen, you're an angel of the household, you're doing this act of love for your family. I mean, they said all those things, but they backed it up with the money. So for the first time, women who had spent their whole lives working for their families and doing the right thing and being the kind of good wife at home and cooking this stuff, they were out there in the world of the cash economy, and they were making money for their own work and their own ingenuity. It was a great thing, and it was a different thing. People didn't put a price tag on the things that women did. We still have a hard time doing that, and it was really true in 1949. So this was a cooking contest that was about more than just this amorphous glory of working at home. It gave you the cash.
Well, Laura, you're a culinary historian. Are you also a cook?
I do what I call sort of ordinary home cooking. It is not very imaginative. In a million years, I could not have come up with a recipe like the one this year. I can follow recipes, and I do it, and I believe in it, but I'm not one of these talented cooks.
But do you think that these competitions have become more competitive, or that's sort of part of the excitement of them? And I'm thinking about the influence of the cooking shows on TV. Seems like there's an endless supply of cooking shows that if you want to watch, you can watch all day and all night long.
Yes, and what's interesting here is that those cooking shows have enormous audiences, and people do watch. People in the food business and the cookbook business are always kind of wondering whether that translates into going into the kitchen and cooking. Nobody really knows, but I think that the fact that so many cooking contests are still out there, the Bake Off and many others, shows that there is some link. You see people doing that, and you want to get out there and try it, or at least it gives you some ideas. One interesting thing about the cooking shows on television is they have big audiences among children. And this was even true in Julia Child's day. This was in the early 60s when she first went on television. Children watched Julia Child, and they loved it. It's not to say that every child went on to become a great cook or any cook at all, but there is something about watching somebody cook, whether it's in their own kitchen or on television, that children get a kick out of. They like it. And I think it probably is true that some children go on.
Well, it's funny you say that. I had a friend whose son, this is many years ago, loved Julia Child, and when she would come on TV, he'd go, "Julia, Julia," and go running to the TV to watch, I guess, his favorite chef. I don't know. Let me introduce you, or reintroduce you, Laura, and that's Laura Shapiro, a culinary historian. She's written several books about women and cooking in America, one called Perfection Salad and the other called Something from the Oven. We are talking about cooking contests, and we do want to hear from you if you've ever entered a cooking contest. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Jeffrey Hauke in on our conversation. He's a food writer, a blogger for the Tampa Tribune. He also was a judge in the sweet treat category for the 2010 and 2012 Pillsbury Bake Off. And Jeffrey Hauke, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me, Mari.
Well, you're very welcome. And we began with Christina Varelli talking about her prize-winning pumpkin ravioli dessert with salted caramel whipped cream topping. Was that the one that you voted for?
It was, yeah. We had three judges in our category. You know, we kind of had 26 desserts to plow through, and then there were 12 judges total, but we all voted unanimously that that should be the winner. And let me tell you, this was an awesome dessert. It was the first dessert that we got in the category that morning, and we called all the judges over that at that moment and said, "You've got to try this." And
wow,
it was just light and airy and crispy and delicious, and I've been craving them ever since.
Now, we have her recipe on our Facebook page. You could make that, Jeffrey.
Absolutely. No, and I told her at the time after she won her big, giant cash check that I was going to make those for Thanksgiving this year instead of pumpkin pies. Right. They were that good.
So how do you get to be a judge at a Pillsbury Bake Off?
I don't know.
You don't know the answer to that?
No, I don't. It was like this super secret Pillsbury Society, I think. I got invited in 2010, and I didn't ask any questions because I thought, nah, maybe they made a mistake and I don't want to alert them to this. So I showed up and I did my job, and then they were nice enough to invite me back for a second year.
Well, Laura, have you infiltrated the Pillsbury Bake Off to figure out how they pick their judges?
I don't know that. I'm sorry to say I did go to a Bake Off once in 1988, and I kind of thought from the press point of view, one of those many people who swarm around the baking floor and try not to interfere with the work, but also interviewing people at the same time. And I know that the whole situation of the judging is taken extremely seriously. I think you're not allowed to read, or they encourage you not to read or even talk about the bake-off for a whole year after you've been selected, so that you're just not going to get any preconceptions or early knowledge of contestants or anything that's happening. They really want you to go in there with a completely open mind.
And are you sequestered there, Jeff?
Oh, absolutely. And she's exactly right. They take it. I mean, the secrecy and the security that they have is just absolutely to the extreme. They put us in this windowless room for about 8 hours as all the food comes in and we finish judging and deliberating. But they have guards at every door. You're not allowed to take any photos. If you're going to take photos, you have to ask for the official Pillsbury photographer to do it, because there's things they don't want to be shown. They don't want to give away any part of the process, so that it's totally fair and equal. And in fact, I just wrote a column for this week's paper about the fact that until we had named a champion, we didn't know who any of these people were, and we really kind of relished the idea of being able to learn that, you know, Christina Varelli is a mother of two and that she volunteers her time at school and church and things, and it really helped personalize it. But before then, these were just dishes on a plate.
Well, do you just devour the dish, or do you take little tiny bites when you're judging a food competition?
I will say this. If you have 26 desserts to plow through,
okay,
your mouth is valuable real estate, and it's, you know, there are techniques. You know, it's a nibbling and it's a tasting event. It's not a, you know, let's swallow the entire Pillsbury Doughboy whole kind of event. So,
because then you would become the Pillsbury Doughboy, yes.
Yeah, and I got a massive headache. Last time I did sweet treats, I got a massive headache, and I thought, okay, I'm going to learn this time and try not to, like, you know, treat this as this, you know, wonderful buffet. But you know, you want to give everyone equal attention, and, you know, you clear your palate after each one and you kind of analyze the recipe and the flavors and look at it on several criteria. But, you know, there's so many great flavors in the category. It's really, really difficult to choose.
And criteria is it just has to taste really, really good. Yes. Bottom line?
There's that. There's a little bit that you judge the complexity of the recipe and how clear the directions are. You look at what the appearance of the dish is because you want it to be visually appealing. You judge flavor. You judge texture. And, you know, somebody already makes sure that the Pillsbury products are, the required Pillsbury products are in the recipe before they ever get to our room, so we don't really have to worry about that.
Well, in fact, I was talking with Laura Shapiro about that, about all the products that must be included in this bake-off. Does it then become a kind of a branding product competition?
I mean, you kind of know that going in, that this is one function, and it is to promote Pillsbury products, but it's also to promote the home cook. And the idea that using these products is an easy thing to do, an affordable thing to do, and you can be creative under that brand umbrella. I was asked whether or not, you know, if you put like 53 different Pillsbury ingredients in there, will it mean you have a better chance? And no, ultimately it has to taste good. So, you know, the number of products you put in is really not, it doesn't have a factor in any of the judging.
And we're talking about a ballroom with something like 100 ovens on the floor of the ballroom? Jeff?
You need to come and see this sometime.
Yeah, well, you've got to describe it for us.
Okay, a giant warehouse-sized ballroom, the biggest ballroom you can imagine in Orlando, Florida, filled with 100 ovens, making 100 different dishes that were never meant to be cooked in the same room, on brand-new equipment by people who have flown in from around the country on their most nervous day ever with brand-new groceries. It's just a spectacle that everybody should see. There's miles and miles of cable that run all the way through. I think one of the first bake-offs, they actually blew out the electricity in the ballroom that they use, if I'm not mistaken, at the Waldorf. So this is a huge technical undertaking. It's a huge logistical nightmare. And the fact that it comes off at all without anybody really making terrible food is kind of, it's amazing to see.
Laura, we were talking about the first Pillsbury Bake Off, and while it maybe wasn't quite as high tech as the one today, certainly pretty high tech for its time.
It definitely was, and you know, when we heard Christina talking about that event, so much of it reminded me of what I had read about 1949, where the cooks march in. I think even then, in 1949, they came all walking in together to the tune of the Saints Go Marching In, and somebody from the Pillsbury family was always there, and they fan out to their little stoves, and they nervously start to cook. Apparently at that first one, they were told that all the ingredients they needed for each recipe would be there at their little kitchenette. Mm-hmm. Even so, some woman, I think from Wisconsin, brought her own eggs. She didn't trust that they could find any in New York. and so much of that feeling of excitement and anticipation and pride in what they were doing that Christina described was absolutely in place starting in 1949.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to talk beyond the Pillsbury Bake Off, but talk about food contests, cooking contests, and we'd love to hear from you if you've ever entered or even won a cooking contest. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Our guests are Laura Shapiro, a culinary historian, and Jeffrey Houck, who's a food writer and blogger for the Tampa Tribune. We'll take some calls after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham have been awarded 3-year terms of accreditation in radiation oncology by the American College of Radiology and the American Society for Radiation Oncology. This accreditation represents Fox Chase's commitment to the high level of quality, patient safety, and technical rigor as specified by national experts in the field. More at foxchase.org and foxchase.org/Buckingham. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Sports writer Joe Drape loves horse racing, so how did he feel about uncovering the horrors of the sport for a recent expose? Also, contraception has been in the news. We'll look back at the relatively recent history of the pill. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY. Catholic Charities Appeal supports WHYY. How did you feel the last time you helped someone in need? It felt good, didn't it? Helping others always does. Catholic Charities Appeal gives help and hope to those who need it. With over 80 programs that offer food, clothes, shelter, and proper care to the homeless, hungry, disadvantaged youth, and developmentally delayed, we make a difference in the lives of so many. Learn how to help at CatholicCharitiesAppeal.org. That's CatholicCharitiesAppeal.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about cooking competitions today on the show with Jeffrey Houck. He's a food writer and blogger for the Tampa Tribune, was a judge in the sweet treat category for both the 2010 and the 2012 Pillsbury Bake Off. Laura Shapiro is a culinary historian. She's written two books about women and cooking in America, one called Perfection Salad, the other called Something from the Oven, and her most recent book was the Penguin Life Biography of Julia Child. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Laura, there are a lot of farms and county fairs in Pennsylvania, like in a lot of states. I've gone to them, and they always have cooking contests. They're not at that level of the Pillsbury Bake Off, but nonetheless, you can try all sorts of breads and pies and, you know, various desserts and things like that. And it seems like that's also a very strong part of our American history.
I think it is. I've always wanted to go out and start tasting some of those things.
Good stuff.
It's amazing that people are doing it. Some of the food industry sponsored contests, the ones that do give cash prizes or a trip to Hawaii or something, some kind of award, they also get a lot of contestants, obviously, from all over the country. What I found from reading about them is that a lot of people who enter these contests are what you might call professional contest enterers.
Oh.
They just really work on creating recipes for these contests, and they know what each one is looking for and the kinds of ideas and the sort of big things you have to do to progress in each kind of category. So there's like a subculture of people who really know how to do this, and some of them win time and time again, a whole range of contests. When you interview some winners of the Bake Off and some of these other things, they have won amazing things. And so there's this whole little world going on beneath our radar of people entering these contests.
And you can make a lot of money and get a lot of publicity as well. But, Jeff, what I like about these county fairs is that things are made from scratch.
Absolutely. You know, I have the pleasure of judging a lot of food contests because it kind of comes with the territory of being a food writer. And one of my favorite things is to judge the Florida Strawberry Festival's canning and preserving category. And it sounds really boring, and it sounds like the old lady hat club, but I got to tell you, there's a lot of creativity there and real diligence and people who are really connected with the ingredients that they use. They do really fun stuff, and the food tastes awesome. And you gotta like the fact that people are still doing that sort of thing in their homes.
And Laura, going back to you, then I do want to get to our callers, but it seems like we're at an interesting place when it comes to food in this country. On the one hand, you've got, you know, foodies who can get ingredients from all over the world. On the other hand, we've got a food stamp crisis, and you've got food deserts and, you know, in poor neighborhoods. It's such a interesting and in certain ways troubling part of our culture and economy.
It really is. People often ask food writers to characterize the state of American cooking today. Well, as I'm sure Jeffrey knows, it's completely impossible. We're a nation of niche markets and niche neighborhoods, and it's possible and it's likely to find people living entirely different food lives in the same city, in the same neighborhood, on the same street. You can eat all packaged foods and fast food. You can make everything from scratch. You can have people who do that within the same family. It's just an enormously varied food landscape right now.
Would you agree with that, Jeff?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's the great thing about living in a place like Tampa is, you know, you're so close to the water, and yet this is a highly agricultural area with lots of beef and cattle industry, and yet 20 miles to the west, it's, you know, predominantly seafood and mostly beach kind of food. And, you know, the fact that, let's put it this way, you look at the Pillsbury Bake Off, not to go back to that again, but there were at least three entries this year that used the empanada as a form to deliver the food. There was one in the sweet category and a couple and the savory. And I think that says something. People are obviously getting influenced by what they're seeing on television and reading in magazines and newspapers, and they're playing around with their food, which is always fun to see.
It's always fun to play with your food. Let me get Art from King of Prussia to join our conversation. And Art, go ahead. You're on the air.
I hope you can hear me, because
yes,
I can hardly hear you.
I can hear you loud and clear, Art. Thanks.
Okay. Back in the early 90s, I entered a contest, a local contest, Norristown, and I submitted recipes for 2 years, and nothing happened. On the third year, out of frustration, I made an ingredient list and wrote down the method of preparation without ever making what I submitted, and won the second prize. I called it Warm Glow Pasta Sauce. And I did it as a joke, because there is large Italian population in that area.
Wow.
and in this area, and all they needed was another pasta sauce recipe. Well, I got second place. The judge, who was a local chef, never tasted it, and I never made it until after I won the prize, and then it turned out real good.
Well, Art, that's let me give both Laura and Jeff a chance to weigh in on that. Laura, it seems like he broke the code here.
I actually have heard of one other case of exactly that, a woman who entered the bake-off with a recipe for something that she had never made. She just wrote down the thing exactly as this caller did, sent it in, was astonished to hear that she had become a finalist, and then had to scurry around and actually make the thing. So I guess it happens.
Jeff, does that happen as a judge yourself?
Well, it happened in the Pillsbury this year, where one of the finalists who won, I think she won $5,000, she made a homemade pizza with, I think it had asparagus and red pepper and artichoke on it. And she said, I had made it once for my family, and my mom, and my daughter said, Mom, you ought to send that into Pillsbury. It tastes really good.
Art, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what John from Haverford has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great show. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
I heard about the food contest, and it's very interesting, and it sounds very exciting. In Philadelphia, at Rangsherman Market, there was a contest with Scrapple, and all the local area pork people and pork enthusiasts got really excited to cook their various indulgent Scrapple recipes. And I work with Fair Food Farm Stand, which is in Rangsherman Market, and we actually cooked with a vegan Scrapple and managed to place second.
You go, John.
So that was a lot of fun.
Well,
and we were actually thankful we didn't win first, because with a vegan product up against Scrapple, it seemed, a little...
kind of a David Goliath dangerous situation.
Yeah, we were very happy with second. And it's really a testament to the good product, too. It's Vrapple, V-R-A-P-P-L-E, and it's good stuff. So,
well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Jeff a chance to weigh in. Scrapple, our contribution to America's culinary appetites.
I'm just putting it out there that I am available for any and all Scrapple competition judging.
Oh, you like Scrapple?
I'm a big fan of the Scrapple. I have family who are up from central Pennsylvania, and friends who lived up there. We actually cooked Scrapple in our newsroom one day, and you wouldn't believe the response. The great thing about what he was saying is that there's a lot of regional stuff here. Like, we have a Flan Fest down here in Tampa. We have a Black Bean Festival. We have all these great food little festivals that are niche things to our own area. And it really makes you feel more like home when you go out and taste the stuff that comes from here.
Laura, are you a Scrapple aficionado?
Actually, I have never tasted it, despite the fact that New York is not that far from Philadelphia. Some of these regional specialties don't really travel too much. And just speaking only as a New Yorker, I have to say the idea of an indulgent Scrapple recipe sounds very startling, but I'd be willing.
You could slum it down here in Philadelphia, right?
Right,
right, Laura? It's interesting. We've had calls from men, and we should not be surprised about that. But even going back to these various contests, and even going back in time, Laura, and your books are really about women and cooking in America, and men are making inroads into the kitchen, and here.
Oh, they definitely are, and there have always been men at the Pillsbury Bake Off, certainly at all these other cooking contests, but that's really not so surprising when you think that home cooking has really been divided into sort of two groups by gender. It's women who have done the sort of every single day, get that meal on the table no matter what, and it's men who step in and do the show-stopping, special thing for guests. Here's my wonderful barbecue or my great salad dressing, or I'm doing the pancakes for the children on Sunday. So men have always done sort of spotlight cooking, while it's women who just do it day after day.
Oh, you sound, make it sound so terrible.
Well,
Jeff, it sounds like hunters and gatherers.
Well, you know what? It is true. There's this dichotomy where a lot of the grilling and the barbecue competitions are mostly men, but you're seeing it from both sides. You're seeing women sort of coming in and being part of those competitions. But, like, for instance, at Pillsbury Bake Off this year, there were five men who were entered, and one of them won one of the big prizes. Brett Yeomans won with the orange cream macadamia tort, and it was delicious. And, you know, like I said, you know, with the judging, you don't know who are men or who are women, but it's fun to kind of see the men, you know, get in there a little bit and mix it up. I think there's only been one man who's ever won Pillsbury, as far as I know, and that was the first year of the $1 million prize. So I think men are just more focused on money.
And Jeff, we should say that Brett, the winner of that particular award, called in earlier to talk to Christina Varelli, as we were talking about the Pillsbury Bake Off. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jeff, do you need to be a good cook to be a good judge, do you think?
Oh, I think it definitely helps. There's an appreciation for what goes into making a dish that I don't know that you can really have unless you've spent time in the kitchen making different kinds of recipes. You know, I'm not saying it's exclusive, because, you know, anybody with taste buds can do it, but at a certain point you have to understand what the effort is involved and how the ingredients go together and meld better.
And Laura, even going back to your biography of Julia Child, just to give her, I guess, a kind of a shout out for what she was able to do to you know, home cooks.
She really thought that the tradition of American home cooking was in great shape from the 60s when she started on television until her death years later. She felt that the tradition of good cooking was being kept alive in this country, more so than in France, even. She said, "And French women do not cook at home." She said, "Americans do, and that is what is going to bring on the survival and the growth of home cooking." When she started in the 60s, she had a somewhat dim view of ordinary American food, but she got much more knowledgeable about it as she lived longer in this country and ate around. And at one time, she was herself a judge for a cooking contest. This was a beef contest, and she loved beef and ate it in many forms all her life and defended it. So she had gone looking forward very much to judging this beef contest, and her notes survived from that. Each recipe was really worse than the last. She was so disappointed.
And as you're talking, I'm hearing her voice, Laura. She has such a fabulous and distinctive voice. Let me get to Teresa from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Teresa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there. Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Hi. I grew up watching Julia, so thanks for shout out to Julia
sure.
for inspiring us all.
And did you have something else? No, go ahead, Teresa.
I entered it's actually Therese,
go ahead, Therese.
Yes, I entered a cooking competition and was selected to be one of five people on the channel, the 10 show, about 2 years ago, and I made it to number two.
Ooh.
But the thing I was most proud of making was a rice cake that Stephen Starr was the judge of that day, and it's a sushi rice cooked and then cooled, mixed in with some scallion shaped into a patty and coated with sesame seed and fried, and served as you would serve sushi with wasabi and pickled ginger. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Starr just loved it. So he paid me the biggest compliment, and that pretty much made my day.
Well, I can imagine the Stephen Starr owning a number of restaurants here in Philadelphia. Jeff, that sounds pretty good. I know you're kind of a dessert judge, but that sounds pretty tasty.
Oh, I try to be the Swiss Army knife of food judging. I'll try anything once. That does sound great, and like I said, you know, you're seeing people play around with ingredients that, you know, sushi rice is about as traditional as it comes, but to see it used in different forms is always a lot of fun as a judge to kind of see where people take it next.
You want to weigh in on that, Laura?
Well, it's a very interesting example of something that has been seen in many cooking contest, certainly in Pillsbury, and then the one that the caller has just described, where ethnic ideas that are not in the mainstream of American cooking, or haven't been traditionally, but they come in, and they come in different ways and with different cooks' imaginations at work at them. So this is a fascinating example of that.
And Jeff, we're almost out of time here. Do you have a favorite cookbook?
You know, I got to go back to Julia Child. I got to go back to Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It's the Rosetta Stone for what happened in America back in the 60s. So it's great reading, not only just for the food, but just the way that she put it all together and made it flow.
Laura, your favorite cookbook?
I have to vote for that big yellow book that Gourmet Magazine put out a few years ago that has a lot of their quick cook and some of the easier recipes. Gourmet was famous for difficult recipes for many years, and then they kind of had a nice turnaround and things got easier, and at that point I became a big fan.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you, Laura Shapiro and Jeffrey Haupt. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Our senior engineer today is Fred Snyder. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us. Closing things out with Eileen Barton's 1950 hit.
Come in. Well, 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 look who's here. I haven't seen you in many a year. If I knew you were coming, I'd bake a cake, bake a cake, bake a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd bake a cake. Hatch-a-do, hatch-a-do, hatch-a-do. Had you dropped me a letter, I'd hired a band, grandest band in the land. Had you dropped me a letter, I'd hired a band and spread the welcome mat for you. Oh, I don't know where you came from, 'cause I don't know where you've been. But it really doesn't matter. Grab a chair and fill your platter and dig, dig, dig right in. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, hired a band. Goodness sake, if I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. Hatcha-do, hatcha-do, hatcha-do.